Thank you for coming back to the Ion College Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Norlander. Listen, this is just a fantastic time of the year. It never gets old, and I mentioned on last week's podcast that I never get sick of this game, no matter what. I'm always surprised. The weekend brought just a handful of either buzzer beaters, true, or game winners with shots that fell in the final few seconds. And so on this episode, I'm bringing on a first-time guest. I've wanted to get him on. Rising star in the college hoops television medium. It's Sean Farnham of ESPN. Sean, how are you doing from Vegas, man?
Hey, you know, I'm at the epicenter of college basketball for championship week with all the tournaments that are here in Las Vegas. Right now, the West Coast Conference. And then, of course, after that, the Pac-12 comes to town, as well as the Mountain West Conference and the WAC. Now, I'll be out of here. I'll be heading back east to the ACC tournament this year on Tuesday. But it's great to be here, and it's been a great environment for college basketball, which is why so many other conferences now are kind of following the leads of some of these other ones.
We can segue to that right now, but we'll get to all the awesome stuff from the weekend, no doubt about it. We're going to touch on everything, bubble situation, seating. We're going to get into that. But I do just want to touch on this conference tournaments in Vegas setup now. We've got plenty between the WAC, Mountain West, West Coast Conference, Pac-12. To me, from the outside, it seems like a pretty brilliant and obvious strategy to do this. But I gotta think, while coaches and programs love this, it's also got to be a little bit of a challenge, right? Because Vegas is Vegas. I mean, no matter what, you're an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, and it's just impossible to not have your eyes widened, to be distracted a little bit. So I think is it right to say it might be a little bit of a double-edged sword? I mean, for example, you know, Gonzaga and St. Mary's, who, in my opinion, thankfully we get for the West Coast Conference title game, both of those teams entered their competition and were certainly sluggish to start off with. So Is that a legitimate challenge that coaches might have to overcome, just the setting of Sin City?
I don't think it's as big as a deal as many people might think. You talk about the sluggish starts for both those teams over the weekend in their first game. Their opponents had played at least one game. In LMU's case, they played three games to be able to get there. San Diego had played two already in the venue. And I think when you have a week off, a little bit of rust factor comes into play. And I think we saw that in particular with Gonzaga against LMU, where LMU came out with 20 minutes of inspired basketball, very physical, very tough at the defensive end, and took away transition looks for the Bulldogs. They only had one transition basket in the first half, and then they had nine points off of transition within literally a minute and a half coming out of the break. So the ability to run and kind of the wake-up call of just being here, I think that was more to do with what we saw. I anticipate on Monday night, we're going to see a championship game that is going to be hotly contested with both teams playing their best. I think the venue itself is perfect for all of the conferences that have made it. Look at the Pac-12 tournament. The attendance has been horrifically bad while it's been in the Staples Center. And I think part of that is because of affordability for fans. You know, if you're a college student, you can come to Vegas, stack six people in a room, and you're paying less than $10 a night. Or if you're at the Staples Center, you're not staying at the JW Marriott or the Ritz-Carlton for that kind of value. So it's a little bit different, but I think that it builds a great environment, and when it's loud and when it's boisterous and when it's sold out, those are where the players usually elevate their games too. Everybody wants to play in front of a pack house, and Vegas provides that type of atmosphere.
I agree, and I predict that this is actually going to be the norm going forward. So long as the attendance is good, to me it's just... And I know that conferences aren't working hand in hand, but they are unintentionally. Just to have so many leagues in one spot, it benefits college basketball because you're going to have more writers be willing to go out. You know, for example, our own Jeff Goodman is probably going to, you know, bother you a bit before you head back east. And there are a few writers that are just going to go out to Vegas because you've got so many different options. It's why out east I'm going to be at the Atlantic 10 and the Big East, because they're so close together. You know, Brooklyn and Manhattan. These things will bring more attention to the sport because they're so close in proximity, as opposed to spreading things out and maybe, you know, as you mentioned, damaging attendance factors, whether it's for price, location, or whatever, right?
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think coverage-wise, you allow the opportunity for more media members to come. And part of, you know, the West Coast Conference this year, I think there's been more credentials requested this year by media members than ever before. Now, part of that may be because the Pac-12 is rolling into town immediately after this tournament is over. The other part of it, obviously, is they have the number one team in the country. And so those kind of things go hand in hand. But making our jobs easy, I think more people should take notes. So what makes your and my job a little bit easier for us to have some fun, get to see multiple teams. You know, I'm looking forward to going back to the ACC, which is still an isolated tournament, but the traditional powerhouse tournaments, so the Big East, the ACC, and the Big Ten, they can put their tournaments anywhere, and it's going to be sold out. And Chicago's going to be rocking next week for the Big Ten tournament, especially after the events of the weekend and how tight everything is and how exciting those games have been all season long. So it's going to be a great championship week. And as we've talked about a couple times already, Las Vegas is a great venue for it. The hotels, there's plenty of rooms for everybody to stay in. It is cheap. It is affordable. The weather is usually really good. And so you can get out. You can have a little bit of fun after the games are over if you're a fan and you're in attendance. If you're a player, you know, it's no different than I think any other venue, though. The main thing is the coaching staff and the administrators of the basketball programs, wherever you're at, when you're staying in hotels, bed checks, making sure people are bought in. And if you're a championship team, that shouldn't be an issue. You know, if you're the Gonzaga Bulldogs, you shouldn't even be thinking about what's going on the Strip or who's in town performing or anything like that. You should be thinking about the opportunities that lie ahead of you to give you the best chance to maybe make a run for a Final Four. If you're a St. Mary's, you know, you shouldn't see anything. There's no question Matthew Dellavedova is not going to let any of his teammates stray. And one of the best leaders in all of college basketball. Keeping it focused, championship-level teams focus on the prize, not on the fun extracurricular activities that you could fall maybe into in an environment like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I still think that, you know, when we get down to it, it is a tough human nature thing to fight because these guys are, imagine, you know it, I just don't know it, of being a 19-year-old kid and getting to travel, being a good team with chances to go to the NCAA tournament, being in new places, and you make good points. I just wonder if certain teams really truly struggle.
Well, I assume there were probably certain teams that came here that did have players that didn't follow in line to what their coaches were wanting. And I bet you that happened. But I also guarantee you that they're not playing still.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the challenge. But, you know, at the same time, I think these championship week events, they're always better when they're packed. And so often we see on TV these empty arenas, and you think to yourself, like, do people not understand this is good basketball? Why aren't we coming out and watching this? This is really good basketball. The Missouri Valley Conference today, the venue in St. Louis has been great for them.
So
the Arch
great.
To the Madness is one of the best championship venues that you'll see. And that's what it should be like for every conference. It doesn't have to be just about the traditional power conferences and how they can sell out or what their venues look like. It should be about every conference coming together and finding out, how can we not only financially benefit from having a sold-out crowd, but create an environment that is worthy of a championship? You know, if you're going to a heavyweight championship boxing match, and there haven't been many great ones here in the United States, but you look at some of those matches that the Klitschkos have had over in Germany, they're sold out. It is loud. It is crazy. When Manny Pacquiao or Floyd Mayweather fight, it is packed. It is crazy. Championship fights, championship basketball games should always be sold out, full of passion. And it's up to the conferences to get together and figure out where is the best place we can go to make sure that we provide a championship environment and a championship experience, not just for our teams, but for our fans, so that they understand the significance of what it is that we're trying to do right now.
Klitschko reference drops on the podcast. This is a new.
Has that ever happened before?
It has not. That is the first, my friend. So that is that is next level, and I love it. By the way, one more quick note on the West Coast stuff. You know, Brad Waldo lost his tooth. It created the funniest image of the weekend because he plays for St. Mary's and he loses his tooth, and he's trying to hand it to Randy Bennett, and Randy Bennett's like, I want nothing to do with that dude. So do we know what happened with the tooth and if he had it put back in yet? I know you were doing some media stuff on Sunday. What's the deal with Waldo's tooth? Is it going to be a game time decision?
Well, he has a Twitter account now. Not Brad, but the tooth actually has its own Twitter account now. It's at Waldo's tooth. So I can neither confirm nor deny reports at this time what the tooth is saying, but I can confirm that last night he had about an hour and a half worth of surgery after the game.
Wow.
To get that put back into place. And the crazy thing was, he didn't lose one tooth. He lost two. The second one was literally pushed back and hanging by a thread. After the game, I did an interview with him just so that we could get the shot and get some sound from him immediately following the game. And we're going to air it in tonight's game for the Gonzaga St. Mary's WCC Championship on ESPN. And he went through an hour and a half surgery. They actually pulled out the second tooth and then put it back in. And so both teeth are now back into his mouth. They're glued in. And he, for lack of a better term, has a wire that has been glued across the front of his teeth. It's not braces, but similar to braces. He will be wearing a mouth guard, and he's in good spirits. And I thought the toughness that he showed last night, I didn't know that Brad Waldo had that in him. And it wasn't just about his performance, obviously. He had a great double-double in the semifinal game to play into the championship game. But he showed a little bit there. And if he's able to show that same kind of toughness against Kelly Olynyk and Elias Harris, he gives the Gales a chance. They need an interior presence to kind of neutralize those two.
Man, I wonder if he got mouth guard advice from Delly. I mean, Matthew Dellavedova's got the most famous mouth guard in the history of college basketball, I feel. So, you know, it's one of those things where do they have a backup on hand that they just toss into boiling water? These are just...
Yeah, I asked Amy Carroll, the trainer, for St. Mary's, have you fitted him for the mouth guard? Yes. Yet. And they said, yes. I said, well, how'd you do it? He goes, well, we had to go down into the kitchen and boil the water.
Love it.
So they're standing in the back of the hotel, inside the kitchen, boiling the water, obviously with hotel management, everybody watching to see what they're doing in the back. They put the mouth guard in, then molded it to his teeth, and I think it's going to be very similar to what we've seen Matthew Dellavedova wear, which will be interesting to see how it affects maybe his wind, his conditioning. He's not accustomed to having something bulky and big in his mouth, but it's mandatory. He cannot play without it in the championship game.
How about that? As for Gonzaga, two quick things. One, are they a number one seed in your opinion, win or lose? Because I think there is some debate, and there's been enough top teams that have taken hits here where even if Gonzaga lose, I think there's a case for and against. And then two, it's of my opinion that regardless if they're a one or a two, minimally, Gonzaga is going to be expected to make an Elite Eight because they haven't done it since 99 when they cracked onto the scene and really became the Gonzaga team that we know them and became a program that was both endearing but also legitimately good. But they haven't gotten back since then. And, you know, in your opinion, is that a legitimate expectation for the nation to have? Because it's going to be there. And do you think that the program feels it? Do you think these players feel it? Do you think Mark Few feels it? Because I sense Gonzaga's moment is coming. The spotlight will get brighter and hotter once Selection Sunday doles out all its seeds.
Well, you know, from the start, you think about Gonzaga and their long lineage. And I'm going to go backwards here on you from your answers or your questions.
It's all good.
But I think that this team is going to be capable of making the type of run that you alluded to, an Elite Eight, a Final Four, and maybe even a national championship game, maybe even a national championship. And there's a couple of things that kind of stand out to me. And look, I think they sense it. I think they understand the importance of being number one, first time in program history that has happened. And Mark Few has never made it about himself. He's made it about his program. And he's built a culture where chemistry, cohesiveness, playing with and for each other is what is valued most. And with all the great teams that they've had, and you mentioned the one that made the run all the way to the Elite Eight, that kind of broke them onto the scene. Mark has told me numerous times that this group is the closest group that he has ever coached. They really enjoy playing with each other. They don't care who gets the glory. If it's Gary Bell Jr. that scores 20 points, Elias Harris isn't upset about it. If Harris goes off like he did in the semifinal game, Kelly Olynyk doesn't get upset about it. They just want to win, and they are doing an excellent job understanding their roles and understanding how to be successful. To me, what makes them a legitimate team to get all the way down to the Final Four is not just their efficiency, where they're second best in points per possession offensively in the nation, but defensively they've gotten a lot better, and a lot of that needs to be credited to Mike Hart. And he's not a guy that in a box score people are going to take notice of, but if you really watch Gonzaga play, he's in position in the help side every single time. He's never out of position at the defensive end. He takes away a couple of options every single possession. And Gary Bell does a very similar thing, even more so out on the perimeter. But when you have two guys that just buy in completely at the defensive end of the floor, it can help take some of the pressure off of Kelly Olynyk or Elias Harris or even Kevin Pangos to have to make those plays defensively. And I think that was the one area of concern I had for a majority of the season is, were they going to be tough enough at the defensive end of the floor to win games where maybe their shots aren't falling, where maybe they're not playing their best basketball, where maybe they're not dictating the tempo and the flow of the game? they have answered that question time and time again, even throughout conference play, and they've risen to that challenge. And I think Mike Hart deserves a lot of credit for their effort at the defensive end of the floor. And if they go all the way to the Final Four, I think more and more people will start to see his hustle, his effort, his commitment to do the little things benefits the more prominent players that we talk about on a consistent basis.
And if they lose, are they still number one?
Oh, yes. You know what? I don't know if they are. And I think I think what you said, too, they can make a point for either one. You could say, hey, look, they're 5-0 against the Big 12 in their non-conference. They won at Oklahoma State. They on a neutral floor, really took it to Kansas State. You know, they beat Baylor. They beat Oklahoma. They did a lot of good things in their non-conference schedule, and they scheduled difficult. You know, that's why they're here at number one. You know, sometimes you can go back to the College Football Reference of Boise State. Why can't Boise State get to the top ranking when they were undefeated a couple of years back? It eventually came down to the quality of games from start to finish. The Zags were able to move up the poll. It's not like they jumped from like 28th to first in 1 week and it was this, oh my gosh, I can't believe this team shot up to number one. They were at number two. They slowly throughout the course of the season have been climbing their way up the rankings, and they put themselves in this position to be number one in the Associated Press. I think what it comes down to is what's going to happen in these conference tournaments. You know, Indiana and their win against Michigan was huge to get the outright Big Ten conference championship in a conference that I covered all season long. That's a statement that they were able to do it without anybody else sharing that title with them. Now they got to go to Chicago and they've got to try to prove that they can win it in a tournament setting. And we've seen time and time again that's not necessarily how it works out. Can Georgetown go and take care of business in the Big East tournament? You know, Miami, Duke, what's going to happen at the ACC tournament coming up? And I think those are the things that you have to watch. Kansas as well. You have to watch all the way throughout the next week. And depending upon what goes on there, if the Zags were to take a loss tonight, they still could be a number one seed. But they don't want to leave that up to anybody else. They want to make that an emphatic yes with a championship here and get back a trophy that they did not receive a year ago as St. Mary's upset Gonzaga here and walked out of here with the automatic bid.
Yeah. I'm of the mind that if Gonzaga loses and still gets a number one, I won't gripe. If they do, you will hear some griping if that does happen. If they win, in my opinion, they definitively should get a number one. And I would gripe if, you know, if it shook out where, you know, Kansas, Duke, Louisville, and Indiana got like number ones. I would have an issue because I would. To me, the West Coast Conference isn't a bad league. It's not a great league. I get that. It's just, you know, it's a top 10/11 league. And to run the table in that, if they were to run the table like and beat St. Mary's and not get a number one after what they did in the non-con, would be pretty egregious. They'd have a gripe. That said, they'd still play in the West, and we'd see how that is. Let's move on though.
Let me ask you this. If we can, you know, people often say, well, how would they fare if they were in the Pac-12?
Right.
How would they fare if they were in the SEC this year? How would they fare if they were in the Big 12 this year?
To me, they win the leagues almost definitely in all three, except maybe Kansas gives them a run in the Big 12.
Right. And probably in all three, by the way, they don't go undefeated.
Yeah.
I think we can agree they maybe take a loss, too, maybe even three losses. But they're still a team that's good enough where they could have won all three of those conferences during the course of the regular season, even going through that grind, when you look at the size, the depth, and the skill that they have at the positions that they have. And I think that's one thing that often gets overlooked by our calling.
I totally agree. Okay, so Indiana-Michigan, just a ridiculously awesome game, fitting in every way, and just how, you know, it ends the Big Ten regular season. It kind of closed up the regular season just in general. So close, I thought Michigan was going to have it. I was actually at my gym working out. It's on the TV, and I'm like running. I'm like cursing myself because I'm like exclaiming so many things as I'm watching. I mean, Trey Burke had this crossover three that went in that was just ridiculous. I just couldn't believe the level of play. You know, and as I was watching it play out, I was like, you know what? I get it. Like, teams in general aren't as good now as they were in 97 and 92 and 85. But I'm watching this game and I'm like, you know what? 10 years from now, I want people to point back to this game in 2013 and just show you that college hoops had some legitimately ridiculously talented teams, like not just talented players and athletes, but just the overall quality. So Indiana wins. They get it on the road to Michigan. In my opinion, if they win one Big Ten tournament game, they're going to be a number one seed. I wanted just to hone in on Michigan just real quick, though, because this is a team I think a lot of people have general doubts about. Talented, but have lost in some certain spots. To me, they got the Big Ten player of the year in Burke. I would take him just barely over Oladipo. Are you one that thinks Michigan might not quite have enough there, might be a little too young to make a Final Four run? Or do you – like, I still think Michigan can get to Atlanta. I like what they have so much, and I think that the young guys have actually matured pretty well over the course of the year.
I think they're the fourth-best team in the Big Ten right now.
Wow.
And I'll explain why I feel that way. And I'm saying that from a tournament perspective. Not in, on an individual, okay, we've got two games this week, but I'm talking about going into the NCAA tournament, how they could fare. I think Ohio State is playing its best basketball of the season right now. And I think Aaron Kraft has become a little bit more aggressive offensively. I think defensively, they are more bought in as a collective group. And they have their star in Thomas that can score from almost anywhere out on the floor as far as creating his own shot, being aggressive. And I really like what Badmont has done down the stretch. I think that to me makes them stand out. I think Michigan State with Adrian Payne and the way that he's been playing down the stretch is at a different level. And, you know, Tom Izzo told me last week when I was there before Wisconsin, we've incrementally taken steps forward. We haven't taken steps back. Even in these three losses, he still felt like his team was getting better. And they had that tough stretch of three consecutive losses. But they weathered that storm. And they weren't, you know, guys like Keith Appling weren't performing very well. In those three losses, he failed to get to 10 points. In any one of those games, and then broke out against Wisconsin. I think that those two teams and Indiana right now would be the three teams that I think have a legitimate chance to get to Atlanta out of the Big Ten. I don't see Michigan being that team, and it's not because I don't believe in Trey Burke. I think he's a first-team All-American, and I think he is the Conference Player of the Year still, even with the late miss free throw and all of that. I still think he's the Conference Player of the Year in the Big Ten. He's been sensational. But their lack of ability to score with someone with their back to the basket, I think will show up in the tournament. As the pace of the game slows down, who's going to be able to score? And, yeah, you can set those on-ball screens consistently and allow Trey Burke to do what he does best, and that's read the options. I called him earlier this year the Colin Kaepernick of college basketball. You know, he sees option one, two, and three, and he makes the read almost perfectly every single time. But if you rely primarily on your perimeter shooting, eventually in some of these venues, you're going to struggle. And when you struggle, how else can you score? Where can you find your baskets? And that is the question that I have for Michigan. Their commitment to the defensive end of the floor in this Indiana game I thought was stellar. I thought they played, for 40 minutes, I thought they played a pretty darn good game on the defensive end of the floor. But rebounding and back to the basket presence deep in the post, I think concerns me going into March.
Okay. Would
you be shocked if Michigan lost to a team like Minnesota in the Big Ten tournament?
Okay. No, I wouldn't. But I'm going to tell you, I wouldn't be shocked if Indiana lost to Minnesota, because they already have. And that speaks to the Big Ten's depth.
Right. No.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, that tournament's going to be ridiculous.
I agree. But that's my point. And the reason I chose Minnesota is because of their tough physical nature underneath with Mbakwe.
Yeah.
And the way that they go after offensive rebounds, the best offensive rebounding team percentage-wise in the country, and how that could impact a team like Michigan. You know, and Michigan's three-point shots that they take often can lead to runouts if you're aggressive. If you're looking to attack Michigan and they miss some of their threes and they're not hitting them consistently, but you can utilize those as almost outlet passes to kind of get your break going.
You mentioned Minnesota. They were one of the teams I highlighted in a post late Saturday night. This weekend offered up a weird array of outcomes and final scores, and I wonder if they'll factor in any sort of way to seeding, or if conference tournament play is going to to kind of scrub over them. But I did want to just run down the entire list real quick here, and then we'll spotlight a couple of games. The big one is Fresno State beating UNLV at UNLV. We will get to that in just a second. That's the biggest one. But, you know, Minnesota gets handled by Purdue. Oregon loses at Utah. Mississippi State, which has not been able to run 5-on-5 practices all year long due to injuries, it beats Auburn. And I know Auburn's not that good, but people do not realize what Rick Ray has or does not have at Mississippi State. NC State is just chilling in how they're playing and not performing. They lose to Florida State, one of the most disappointing teams of the year. Air Force takes out New Mexico, and you just wonder if New Mexico, you know, they had the regular season in the bag preparing for the Mountain West tournament. They fall. The only bubble team that took a really big hurt this weekend, in my opinion, was Colorado, which lost to Oregon State 64-58. Virginia took out Maryland. We'll get to that toward the end of the podcast. Oklahoma loses to TCU, and the Sooners should be in, but that's, I don't know. I thought that was a little surprising because, remember, TCU is a pretty bad team. Baylor just beating Kansas the way they did, 81-58. That was just weird to me, and Kansas backdoored into another conference tournament championship, so that helps Baylor's cause. And then the 10th one was Louisiana Tech getting beat handily by Denver, and after La Tech basically rolled through the first 16 games of the WAC season and was building a minor at-large case, they're not anymore. They're boom or bust for the WAC tournament. So from all those 10, I did want to focus in on two of them. We'll go first, Fresno State, UNLV. Sean, what's up with Vegas? You can easily, without a doubt, I think it's inarguable top 10 talented team in the country. You could make the case it's top five, yet they, I know they're young. I don't get it. Is it the coaching? Is it the system that they're using? UNLV should not be this average, and yet they are.
I think it comes down to point guard play. Anthony Marshall is not a true point guard. And when you need to settle your offense and you need to get guys in order, and maybe people are starting to go off on their own island a little bit chemistry-wise, or just even in their own half-court set, like, hey, I'm going to get mine on this possession, now, who's the guy that's going to bring them back in on this roster? Talent is one thing. Cohesiveness is a completely other thing. And I don't see a group right now that has that one player that can grab everybody by their jerseys, pull them in and talk to them and calm them all down. I mean, I go back to when I played at UCLA. Earl Watson was a tremendous leader on the floor. And we had a lot of guys that had dynamic personalities. We had a lot of talent on some of those rosters at UCLA with guys like Matt Barnes, Ben Gazzareach, even though he was at Zurich when I played with him, Jerome Moiso, Jerron Rush, I think Jason Capono, guys that went on and had great careers and played in the league for a couple of years. Earl Watson was an incredible leader. He brought the best out of everybody. And when guys started going on the own island, he didn't care who you were. He was going to grab you by your jersey and bring him back. And he did that more often than not. I think when you look at UNLV, they don't have that guy on the floor. And it can't just come from the coach every single time. You know, eventually you need to have a voice and a leader out on the floor making plays and decisions for you on a consistent basis. And UNLV doesn't have that right now. And the shocking part of the loss to Fresno State, if this game was at Fresno, I'd be like, oh, well, UNLV doesn't win on the road. That's been proven over the last 2 years. They just do not win on the road in conference play. But to lose at home, that's what shocks me more than anything, because they have no business losing in the Thomas and Mack Center. It's a great home court advantage. It's going to be a great home court advantage for them in the Mountain West Conference Tournament. And what it shows me is that this team isn't focused on the task at hand. It's not aware enough about itself, about what's at stake right now when you get to March. It's March. I don't care if your conference tournament is about to begin. You need to come with that tournament mindset well before you even hit March 1. And once you get to March, you need to approach every game as if it's a one-game season. And I didn't see that at all out of UNLV yesterday, on Saturday, rather. And it really stood out and shocked me. And I think Coach Rice has a lot of things that he needs to answer prior to this tournament starting up this week.
Yeah, and that's a sweep for Fresno State of UNLV this year. Just really weird. And the other one I wanted to get to, similarly, you know, you're going to see him when you go see the ACC tournament, is NC State. To me, UNLV and NC State are fated to bow out the first weekend, and the season kind of goes up in plumes just like that, and you kind of just standing around like, what the hell happened? I mean, NC State's a really talented team. To me, it's, you know, I was big on Lorenzo Brown in the preseason. He's underperformed a little bit. My criticism of CJ Leslie has been the same as it always has. I mean, he just does not have enough consistency, whether it's in his play or mentally. He can't be the guy that lifts this team as much as fans or anyone might want him to. But can you diagnose what's up with the Wolfpack? I mean, They and maybe it's partly the media's fault, Sean. I mean, they were picked to win the league for the first time in decades, and they clearly are not equipped to do that. So what's up with this team?
I think it kind of it's funny you bring up both these games. I think it's almost mirror images.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that you know it's great that you bring up C.J. Leslie. And when I covered NC State earlier this year in December, you know, Coach Godfrey was really quick to say, you know, we go where C.J. Leslie goes when he plays really hard, and we can get him to sustain his focus and sustain his effort. We are a really good team. But when that doesn't happen, we struggle, and we've seen those struggles continue. And I think that even more so, you have this talented recruiting class that comes in that believe, hey, look, we're ranked number one in the immediate preseason poll for the ACC, and all these people are saying we're a top five team because we showed up. Same time, you have all the upperclassmen going, hey, we took this team to the Sweet 16 last year. This is our program. And so I think there's a little inner conflict between the upperclassmen and the underclassmen as far as whose team is this. And the cohesiveness has never really clicked there. Similar to what I was just talking about with talent and parts. You know, I have an 8-year-old son. If my son asked me about chemistry, and he asked me about why when he's watching me talk about teams, I always talk about the importance of working together. And sometimes the most talented teams don't win. And living in Los Angeles, we hear about the Lakers all the time. So last week I went up to his room and he goes, why aren't the Lakers winning? And I said, well, let me show you. And I took part of his Star Wars like cockpit for one of his fighter jets. And then I took part of a police car. And then I took part of a house. And I put it all together. And I said, these are great parts to individual Legos. How does this look? He goes, it doesn't look like anything. And I said, exactly. And I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about UNLV and North Carolina State. They got great individual parts. But if those parts don't fit and mold together to demonstrate one solid item or one solid block of unity, then you have issues. And that's what we see in a lot of these teams right now. And it's not just those two that we've mentioned, but it's across the landscape of college basketball, the individualism of the game. And I think that's predicated upon their experiences at high school and AAU basketball. And, you know, in AAU basketball, it's not necessarily, you know, it's become a factory of, it's not how your team performs, it's how you performed in front of the right people. And did you perform well enough to get the chance to go play in college? And that individual identity, I think, is, to a certain extent, destroying the team philosophies of the game, which is why when you look at the teams that are at the top, and when we talk about teams and programs that are potential number one seeds this year, in most cases, those are the teams that are, they have talent, but they play together and they are cohesive. And that individual idea, even with their talent, somehow, some way, whether it's leadership from the coach, leadership from within, it gets pushed away.
All right. Great stuff there, too. And come summertime, that's something definitely I'd love to expand and extrapolate on. Want to do some quick hits here on a few more teams because it was such a loaded weekend. 30 seconds or less. Give people an idea of what the expectation should be of Creighton. Won the Valley, good offensive team, plays defense when it feels inspired. And I know matchups mean a lot, but, you know, this is a team that preseason was expected to be a second weekend kind of team. Do you think that should still be an expectation, or do you think that they're limited, in the general allotment of opponents they might get? You know, might we want to just hold back?
In the allotment of, where I see them going in the tournament, I don't know if they can make the second weekend.
Yeah.
I really don't. They have not shown me enough consistently at the defensive end of the floor for me to believe that they're going to be ready for the tournament. And yes, McDermott is outstanding, and he is fun to watch. And when he throws up some of those big numbers, we all look at the stats and go, 80% from the 3-point line in this game with like 40 points? Are you kidding? But he can do that, and can he have a Wally Szczerbiak run in the NCAA tournament where he really leads his team? Yes, he can. But I don't think defensively that they're committed enough to make it to the Sweet 16.
All right, I'm going to do a couple either ors. Just who you'd rather, not who you'd rather have in the field, but just who you'd take in a neutral court game in the middle of a Jacksonville gym or something tomorrow. Okay, just give me your team and then we'll move on. Kentucky or Wichita State?
Kentucky.
Okay. St. Mary's or Iowa State?
St. Mary's.
Okay. What about Villanova or Tennessee?
Tennessee.
Okay. What about Baylor or Akron? You know what? That's not a good one because they just lost their
point. That's not a good one because I can't do it without the point guard. You know,
right.
I mean, if
yeah,
the point guard was there, I'd say Akron.
Yeah, which, by the way, we won't even get into that, but Alex Abreu was busted for marijuana trafficking at the worst possible time. This happened late last week. That was just we're,
it reminds me of Drexel. It reminds me of Drexel a year ago in the CAA.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. You know, when you lose a player this late and it ruins and derails the season, because I thought Akron was on the verge to maybe make a great run in the NCAA tournament, become maybe that Ohio from a year ago.
I know. Very frustrating, and I can't imagine what Keith Dambrot must be saying when he's in rooms with no one else around. How about this, then? Baylor and Virginia, which beat Maryland to sweep the Terps on Sunday night.
I go Virginia.
Okay, so why do you like Virginia more than Baylor, who obviously always, someone tweeted, Baylor always passes the eye test. I actually thought, no, they don't always pass the eye test because your eyes lie to you. Why your pick there?
Tony Bennett. His system, the way, if those two teams were in a gym in Jacksonville, Florida by themselves, I think the way he can slow down the game,
yeah,
and take away your first and second options, really stand out to me. And in tournament settings, I think that's where Tony Bennett really can thrive too. And Harris is just a unique scorer, and his ability to fill it up, I think the consistency of his ability to fill it up stands out to me as well. That's why I would go with them. I think they've been, even though they've had some games like Old Dominion, when you go back and you look and you go, really, you lost to Old Dominion? How'd that happen? I still think when I watch Virginia, Tony Bennett would be a difference maker in that game.
All right. We'll wrap up the specific college basketball team talk here. Give me your three, you know, your three favorites to win the title entering big time conference tournament championship week. You know, any three teams that are out there, if you were, you know, a betting man or, you know, gun to your head, you only have three options. And if you're wrong, then bye-bye. Sorry to get macabre on you, but you get what I'm saying? Like, give me.
Thanks. Jeez, are you telling me something? You're looking me on the show and now you're threatening me.
Yeah.
No, I'd go with Duke. I think Duke, obviously, they haven't lost a game with Ryan Kelly has played in.
Yep.
I think his ability to stretch out the defense opens up things for Mason Plumlee underneath. Even though he did not play well against North Carolina over the weekend, Mason Plumlee flourished with a huge double-double, and I think that credited to how much attention had to be given to Ryan Kelly on the outside. I think when you look at other teams that kind of might be peaking at the right moment, I still believe that Louisville has a chance.
Mm.
I think their defensive focus has to be there. Their guard play has to be crisp and sharp. But with Smith and Siva, I think they just, in the tournament, it does come down to guard play. And those two, if they're playing their best games, can lead their team to a national championship. And then outside of that, I go Indiana.
Yeah.
I think that the Hoosiers consistently have been there. They played the most difficult conference schedule that was available for them. They had a pretty good non-conference schedule as well. And they've positioned themselves to be the top overall number one seed. I think they should enjoy that.
Yeah. I don't want to get too deep into Pittsburgh, but just a quick note on Pittsburgh. They're number six in KenPom, 24-7. They're just like no one's paying attention to them, and I get why. I'm going to be interested to see what they do in Manhattan and then what they do when they get to the tournament. They never do well when there's high expectations. I just wonder, you know, KenPom system isn't always right, but sometimes it's got these sneaky teams that end up performing pretty well, and you're kind of like, haven't you paid attention to what they've done for the past 6 weeks? So we'll see. Wanted to change gears as we wrap up the podcast. First, you know, Jason Lisk is a fantastic writer for The Big Lead, and he did a massive profile on you, and it kind of detailed, you know, who you are, how you got into the business. So I just wanted to ask, you know, when he approached you, were you just kind of like, why do you want to do a feature on me? Not that you're not worth it, but I'm just, you know, I was just wondering what your reaction was. And
well, I got a call from the PR department at ESPN saying, hey, there's a gentleman that would like to do an article on you. And I said, okay, no problem. They like kind of like to follow you around for a day. And I said, all right, where, you know, when are we going to do this? And they kind of chose the date to do it. And you know, I was honored. You know, the college basketball game and giving back to the game as much, I'm all about the passion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think and I hope that anybody that read that article gets a sense that you know, I enjoy my job. I love what I do. But if it's ever about me, then I'm not doing my job properly. I want it to be about the kids. I want it to be about the coaches. And I want to celebrate the game of college basketball, regardless of whether or not we talk about how the points per game have dropped or how there might not be the same kind of stars that we saw, as you alluded to earlier, as far as the quality of stars across the landscape of college basketball. I enjoyed the piece, and I enjoyed getting to know Jason a little bit. And I thought that he did a really good job, to be honest with you. And I've been a blue collar guy my entire life. All I know is to work hard, and all I know is that I got to get better every day. And I wake up in the morning and I try to figure that out. You know, even on a day like today, I'm going to watch 4 or 5 games before I get over to the arena for the West Coast Conference Championships. I'll watch both the Zags and St. Mary's games, and then I'll start my preparation for the ACC tournament that actually began over a week ago. And I'm almost done with my game boards, and the tournament doesn't start till Thursday. Huh. You've got to stay ahead. You've got to stay hungry, and you got to just get better.
I love it, dude. Google. I'll link it if you're listening and you check CBS the blog. It'll be linked in the podcast rundown. But Sean Farnham, the big lead. Google it, Jason Lisk. It'll come up. It's very much worth your time. And in that, Lisk links back to Dan O'Neill's fantastic story on Hoops from Home. I know Goodman's done some stuff on the blog. This is pretty awesome. This is something that I feel deserves some good pub, and not just in the June, July, August months when the sport is obviously in the background here. You know, here we are in March. I figured, why not, have you on and just have you run down what Hoops from Home is and what it's about.
Well, I appreciate it. And, Hoops from Home is a passion that was born actually watching the UConn-Butler National Championship game. That was not a real memorable game as far as the shooting clinic goes. So I had some time to think about, if I ever had a platform to give back, how would I? And military has been a very special part of my family. My wife's uncle was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. He retired a couple years ago now from that post. And over the last decade or so, I saw firsthand how our soldiers were being affected by the conflicts that we were sending them to. And then I started looking past that, and I started looking towards the kids. And I think they're a forgotten voice here. I travel a lot. You travel a lot. For 6 months out of a year, as far as college basketball goes, I'm on the road probably 6 days a week. But every night I can Skype my family. Every night I can talk to them. I can help my son do his homework and prepare for a spelling test. Our service members, our men and women, they don't have the same options when they're over in battle. And we put them into combat. They very rarely get those opportunities. And they may only have 5 minutes once every 2 weeks to call back home. And during those 2 weeks, those kids are going to school and they're being asked to perform every bit as well as everybody else in their classroom. And yet they don't know whether or not their parents are in harm's way. And they don't know whether or not they're going to return. And they've seen over the last 10 years plus some of their friends' parents come back in boxes. And because of that, I started to understand the statistics are mind-boggling as far as the use of prescription medication for anxiety and depression and all those things that can stack up against these kids. The amount of truancy and some of the issues that they face, the socioeconomic background of these families when you're not an enlisted officer, all of a sudden now you're not making a lot of money. It's not like they're getting rich off of serving our country and sacrificing for all of us. And so it's not a military thing. It's not a war thing. It's looking at a group of children that need our help and need our assistance. And so as the program has started, we ran 3 events in the past year, our largest being at Camp Pendleton. We had over 150 kids, 12 Division I college athletes, student athletes there in attendance. We also had 5 NBA players and or coaches. Mike Brown, the day after Dwight Howard was traded, was at our clinic helping out these kids, talking to these kids, and you should have seen their faces. I mean, it was remarkable. It was every bit as much as enjoyable as it was when I saw Aaron Kraft speak to him at the Carey Classic this year that was in Charleston, South Carolina, and we did a joint base effort. And we had the Notre Dame women's program, both Ohio State's programs, men and women, as well as Marquette. And it was just wonderful to see these kids lose themselves for a day and let them know that somebody's been thinking about them and somebody cares. And right now we're in the midst of a capital campaign trying to fundraise for us to have sustainability. We need to have some money and we need to grow so that we can continue to get even further goals that we have as far as setting up academic scholarships for military children based on our 3 principles of integrity, initiative, and intent. It's not based solely on your grades, but it's based more so on those founding principles. The last two, obviously, intentness and initiative, both came from the Pyramid of Success. And my time at UCLA as a player and getting to know John Wooden, the Pyramid of Success is often a place that I look for advice and to find success.
That's great stuff, and hoopsfromhome.org is where you can visit to learn more, see more, and you hit on a lot of the important stuff there, man. Really appreciate you taking some time on the podcast. Follow him, by the way, on Twitter, at Sean Farnham, and Farnham is F-A-R-N-H-A-M. Thanks so much, man. Appreciate you coming on, and we'll cross each other's paths soon, okay?
I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
All right, appreciate it. We'll be back Wednesday with the Goodman and Parrish podcast. We'll talk to you then.